yes, it's Jim Brown again with another Outrig Capercast. This is number 25. I've spoken a lot here about cruising as a family and sailing with both of my sons. Perhaps it's time for a story here about what's been called Shakespeare's Dark Lady, cruising with my wife Joanna. That's two words, Joe and Anna. She grew up in Kansas, Wichita, took her degree in piano, ended up teaching music in Chicago, and serving drinks in a folk music nightclub. And like me, she soon became part of that greatest migration of all from all over the United States into California in the mid-1950s. Something like 10,000 people a week moving into California. We met at a party in Sausalito. She was teaching school in San Francisco, and I was working in a boat factory. We went for one flat, calm, moonlight sail on San Francisco Bay. She had sailed once before. And the next thing we knew, like 18 years later, we were beating up through the Caribbean in our 31-foot trimaran Scrimshaw, which I had designed and built in my backyard in California. And after running out of gas in the Panama Canal, the subject of our previous podcast number 24, we sailed out of the canal into the Caribbean, turned right, and went over to spend a month in the San Blas Islands. And as usual, it was Joanna who led the way by studying up on where we were headed. This was 1974, long before the internet, of course, but there was still plenty of information available. We always knew where we were going and pretty much what we would find when we got there. Thanks in large part to the Seven Seas Cruising Association that published a little quarterly manual composed largely of letters written in by other cruisers. It was the best source of current information. So when we cleared in to the San Blas Archipelago, we knew enough to ask for a guy named Charlie Harris. There's a whole lot to be said about the Kuna people of this region. They consider themselves to be the last pure race of people on Earth, that is, genetically undiluted from their original Amerindian stock of northern South America. So we found Charlie Harris. He was a full-blood Kuna Indian, but he had worked in the Panama Canal Zone and taken an English name. He spoke some English. Now, the San Blas Islands, S-A-N-B-L-A-S, Islands, is a string of small islands scattered along the northern coast of Panama headed off toward Colombia on the Caribbean side. And the people there are protected by the Panamanian government. They have deeds to their land. It's an amazing territory of the so-called Darien jungle, so thick and wet as to be impassable up until, I think, the 1980s, when they did finally cut a road through the Darien jungle to complete the Pan-American Highway. But I'm told that that portion of the Pan-Am Highway has since been washed out by a hurricane and is no longer passable. That may not be current information. But anyway, the Kuna people have a large swath of that jungle and the islands that run along close ashore on the north side. And they choose to live on the islands as bedroom communities. And they commute by dugout canoe to the mainland, up their rivers, to their fields, to tend their fields and harvest, and to collect fresh water and take it back to the bedroom communities on the islands. They choose to live on the islands because it's more healthful and safer than living in the jungle. And so the islands are literally jammed with thatch and wattle huts. Now and then one of them, particularly the chief's hut, will have a TV antenna sticking up. But really, in many places, one could barely pass between the habitations. The first thing one notices about the people is the women. They are extremely wholesome-looking and very stylishly decked out in their native textiles. Particularly the bodice panel on the women's blouses. It's very highly decorated with a technique called reverse appliqué. Several layers of cloth of different colors are basted together and then cut down through, and the edges folded back to show a pattern of different colors, folded back and stitched down to show a design that is unique to each blouse. These are the so-called mola textiles that have become quite available in the Western world because the ladies have taken to making them and selling them for profit. And the women are adorned in other ways. They have broad bands of beadwork around their wrists and ankles, bright orange and green. And the married ones among them have gold rings in their noses, big heavy hunks of gold that are split so as to fit around the divider between the nostrils. And these gals rule the roost. It's pretty much a matriarchal society. The men behave like puppy dogs unless they get off by themselves, particularly out in a boat. And then they become quite masculine and animated. But it's almost always exclusively the women that approach incoming cruising yachts in their dugout canoes. And before you can even get the anchor down, these gals are climbing aboard. It's not a matter of, may I have permission to come aboard? They are climbing up. I have a great shot of Scrimshaw taken from the second spreader looking down on a cluster of dugout canoes around our boat, together with our, at that point, very funny-looking little fiberglass dinghy. We couldn't speak hardly a word with these gals, but they poured through the boat, examining everything, especially the publications. We felt that they were looking for ideas for new graphics for their Mola textiles. I had brought along a Polaroid camera and began taking photos of these gals and giving them the prints, and that was a great favorite among them. They were just, some of them, aghast to examine for the first time an image of themselves. And once we had gone ashore, I was taking pictures with both cameras, 35mm slides, and I have some wonderful pictures of these ladies. They, when you would ask them permission to photograph them, they would say yes, but they'd run off into their huts, spend a few minutes, come out decked out in their very best finery, including great medallions of gold strung around their necks all the way from shoulder to shoulder. At one point, they started clowning with Joanna, got her into one of their molas, put a gold ring in her nose, which made her sneeze. Otherwise, we learned, the women are not allowed to leave the islands and come back. They're allowed to leave, but if they do, they cannot come back, for fear of genetically diluting the race. And furthermore, when we were there, men from the outside world are not allowed to spend overnight on the islands, and even visiting ashore after dark was very much frowned upon by the chief. But we invited Charlie Harris to sail with us. He didn't often have the opportunity to hop from one island to another in his own territory, and he paved the way for us, opened up the way to the culture and the territory. And as a matter of fact, he was able to arrange for us to come ashore at night to witness some of their local traditions. And I've written about that in my book. It's a long story. It doesn't really belong here. But Joanna and I had already started on our collection of Central American textiles from our time in Guatemala. And here we were in Mola territory. So every place we went, we were looking for molas. And we came home with a wonderful collection, especially some of the older ones we have, which were made from natural dyes, etc. They range from incredible abstract images down to portrayals of local flora and fauna. This was all over 40 years ago, and yeah, that stuff still hangs in our domicile here, in our chicken house home. One thing we learned as a family traveling on a small boat is that there had to be room for everyone to have their own project. The boys were always making stuff in their bunks. My gosh, Russell was building model airplanes. We had sticks and glue and paper all over the place. Stephen got into making waterproof matches in highly decorated boxes, selling them to other cruisers. He dipped every match in paraffin, and oh man, we had wax here and there and everywhere. And Joanna and I had our textile collection, and we pored over that stuff, just had a wonderful time with it. We had never been interested in art or collecting anything until we began to pick up on the wonderful textiles with which Central American natives adorn themselves. The Kuna men were quite plain. They dressed themselves in, you know, tattered walking shorts and shirts and T-shirts. But the women, besides their incredible blouses, which we're told evolved after the missionaries came along and told them that they had to put clothes on, and they had previously been really into body painting, and so these bodices on their blouses was, you know, the evolution of body painting. And I had a chance to see a little of that when I had visited the sandblast some 18 years previously when I was schooner bumming. So I was coming back, and I dearly loved showing my wife and kids what I had seen so many years before. The boys and I had a great adventure going up one of their rivers in dugout canoes to harvest from their fields and bring water back to the islands. It was a really great excursion. We learned a lot about the perfection of dugout canoes and realized that one of the great problems the Kuna people had was finding containers in which to carry water. They were using every possible vessel, including rusty tin cans and half of eggshells for carrying water back to the islands. So we came back to Scrimshaw and scrounged up every possible container. There were other cruising boats in the area. The boys went around and gathered up everything they could find. Gave a lot of it to Charlie Harris, and he was able to ingratiate his friends. He told us of a more distant key farther offshore that was used only for growing coconuts, not permanently inhabited. Said that his people were going out there to tend their coconut trees, and that he'd like to go out there too. Well, we took him along with us, went out to, I can't remember the name of the key, had quite an exposure to these folks living in a temporary camp, little lean-tos, for several days working on their coconut trees. It was really nirvana out there. And at one point, moving eastward, hopping from one island to the other, Stephen asked if he could make the trip alone in the dinghy. Oh, man. It was a distance of about 4 miles in the open sea along the outside of a nasty reef. But Joanna and I both believed in giving the kids as much freedom as they could handle as early as they could handle it. And it looked to me like Stephen was ready for such a voyage on his own. So we turned him loose in the dinghy and let him go for a while, then took off in Scrimshaw. He made it, even though we held our breath, because he was sailing along rather close to the break line of this reef. We were somewhat farther outside of it watching him, and we've got a picture of him bobbing along there with a great big wave breaking inside of him. We also took the local fellows spearfishing, and I must say that I had had something to do with introducing a mask and fins to the sandblast people some 18 years before. And in just that time, I noticed how profoundly depleted the fish resource was now in the 70s in the San Blas Islands. The fish had gotten wise. The few that were left, the big ones, were all deep, deeper than we could dive by holding our breaths. These guys had their own equipment now, and they were spearing anything and everything. Trigger fish, angel fish, little reef fishes, gleaning everything they could from the water that they could reach. And so it goes as technology invades the last great wilderness. Well, we continued east from the San Blas along the coast of Colombia and ended up in Cartagena, where I had been before, and I was so pleased to find that we all agreed it was our favorite port city of the whole cruise. We were able to berth Scrimshaw in a portion of the old fort that the Spanish had built for accumulating the gold that they were sacking from the Inca people. So Cartagena has a great history of Spanish conquest and pirate conquest. For Henry Morgan and his boys did manage to spirit away a bunch of Spanish gold. We felt secure enough about the place so that for the first time we decided to leave Stephen and Russell alone on the boat while Joanna and I traveled overland. We went up into the Andes and down into Ecuador, looking with some success for textiles, of course. And back on board, we learned that the boys had done just fine without us. It was a great accomplishment. They made friends with the local kids, and they were all a bunch of street urchins, at least that's what they looked like, dressed in bathing suits and nothing else. And Russell told the story of sitting on the wall with his friends outside a popular tourist restaurant. A tour bus arrived, discharged a bunch of tourists into the restaurant, and when they came out, there was one woman who was examining these kids sitting on the wall. Took pity on the blonde one, came running over, stuffed a dollar in his hand, and ran back. And he said, wait, I'm not poor. She ducked into the bus, and with the dollar, he and his friends all had those shaved ice fruity freezes available from so many pushcart vendors. We felt secure in leaving the boys there because they were not altogether by themselves. Our particular friends in another boat, the Kajak, were Sean and Pid Rafter, who we've stayed friends with over the years. They agreed to keep an eye on the kids. And Joanna and I were able to call the Rafters from Bogota, Colombia, and Quito, Ecuador, and learn that they were doing fine. Well, from Cartagena, we steered Scrimshaw north, a little west of north, up through the southwestern portion of the Caribbean, headed for one of my favorite places in the world, I think the place where I became absolutely branded as a sailor, a couple of little islands off the coast of Nicaragua called San Andres, or St. Andrew's Island, and Providencia, or Old Providence Island. It was a very close reach in rather rough trade wind conditions, and we pushed our little overloaded boat like she had never been pushed before. But she was beating us to death. She wanted to go 7 knots, and we realized that in order to live through it, we were going to have to throttle back to about 4.5 knots. Joanna did a great job of keeping us fed and rested, while also trading watches. Again, no self-steering in the boat at that time. I felt it was important for everyone to have something crucial to do, and that was guide the ship. So after a couple of 3 days and nights of bashing to a windward, we arrived at San Andres Island, and I must say, it was fabled in my mind, and I was bound to be very disappointed in what had happened there. You know, tourism, development. So we continued northward another 50 miles to Providencia, my old utopia, and found that pretty much the same thing had happened here. In my previous life, these islands had been owned by Honduras, but they were now Colombian territory, and they had been exposed to investment, better said as exploitation. But our intended destination was actually back to Guatemala, but on the Caribbean side. We knew where we were going. We were headed for the Rio Dulce, and we knew that that place had not yet been, well, exploited, or even discovered by the wider world. But the route from Old Providence Island, which incidentally had been Morgan's hangout when he was raiding Cartagena, back in the days of the Spanish Main, but the route from here to the Rio Dulce is strewn with reefs and requires passing around a great cape that sticks out on the eastern end of Honduras called Cabo Gracias a Dios, Cape Thank God, appropriately named by Columbus when he finally managed to beat around it in 4. Now, I had passed this way many years before as a schooner bum, but coming from the north, when the Caribbean's northeasterly trade winds had been fair for us. Now here we were in Scrimshaw, headed up again on a very close reach through a long and fairly narrow channel that made its way between great banks of reef on one side called Quitasueño, Nights of Little Sleep, and on the other side, Abre Ojos, Keep Your Eyes Open. Now, this is a truly wild piece of ocean, completely absent of navigational aids until you get somewhat farther to the north, where there's a tiny American outpost on Swan Island that has at least a radio direction finder beacon. So Joanna and I knew that we were now facing perhaps our greatest navigational challenge together. And it was the navigation, perhaps more than any other facet of the voyage, that really brought Joanna and I together as captain and mate, and, not incidentally, man and wife. We had done well so far with navigation, going mostly by what's called piloting and dead reckoning. We had needed very little practice with celestial navigation. We had often pored over the charts and books together, checking and rechecking one another's work, and often finding that one or the other of us was wrong. So we both really scrutinized the chart for this run up around Cabo Gracias a Dios, and saw that the safest way was to go all the way to Swan Island, which was much farther than we needed to go if there was only some way for us to get through that reef on the western side, the Nights of Little Sleep Reef. And it looked like with Scrimshaw, with about a 6-foot draft, that we could get through in places. But there were no navigational aids, no lights or markers whatever in the region. So I figured I needed a little local knowledge. I asked around and was told to go visit Captain John Bull. I was told that he had been the skipper of the island's last pure sail-powered trading schooner, a vessel which literally kept the islands afloat in the old days by making just this passage up around Cabo Gracias and down to the Honduras city called La Ceiba. So I was told where John Bull lived and started walking around the southeastern side of the island and over to the windward side. I was told to look for a small, isolated house in a dense, beautiful coconut grove, painted yellow with green shutters. Well, in a mile or so, I came to the unmistakable location, saw that all the shutters, which hang from the top of the windows, were propped open, and the top half of the Dutch door also was open. So I walked up and announced myself, and was soon greeted by a most remarkable personage in the upper part of the door. A big, dark mulatto man in a white t-shirt, with white hair and a white Hemingway beard. There was a loud and constant roar from the trade wind pegging in over the surf and rattling the palm fronds. I rather breathlessly introduced myself and stated my purpose. Could he advise me on the passage from here around Cape Thank God? He examined me for a moment and without opening the door said, "You got a chart?" Well, I said yes, but stupidly I didn't have it with me. He said, "Bring it tomorrow, 10 o'clock. That was that. Well, the next day I was invited in to his extremely simple abode, where he obviously lived alone. It had been many years since he and his schooner had retired. Incidentally, his vessel's name was Sea Runner. But I think the guy had been up all night polishing his accoutrements. Laid out on the oilcloth of his little kitchen table was his box compass with a 4-inch card in a nice little mahogany box, his sling psychrometer, which I had never seen before in the Caribbean, an instrument for predicting the advent of fog, his log line, an instrument for throwing over a chunk of wood attached to a spool of line at the bow, counting the seconds that it took for that log to pass the stern and thereby determining the speed of the ship. He had a beautiful pair of one-hand dividers, apparently handmade by hammering out the brass. And his parallel rule was a chunk of 1-inch diameter bronze propeller shaft, polished to its russet gleam. It must have weighed 5 pounds. He could put it on the chart parallel to his course line and roll it across the chart to the compass rose and read the course in degrees. He also had a fairly modern aneroid barometer, of which he was very proud, but it was not nearly as beautiful as his other instruments. We used his treasures to hold down my chart on the table, for the wind was blowing in through the open windows, no glass, just shutters, and without speaking, he laid his propeller shaft on the chart and laid out a course from Providencia up through the reefs and labeled it, I can't remember, 340 degrees, M, magnetic. Then he asked, "How fast do you go?" I told him the boat wanted to go 7 on a close reach, but that we had to slow her down to about 4.5, keep from getting beaten up. He repeated, 4.5 knots. "You sail with engine running?" he asked. "No, Captain," I said, "small outboard motor, cannot run in open sea." "Then how much leeway you make?" I said, "Relatively little, Captain. We have a deep centerboard, draws 6'6". In these conditions, we make maybe 5 degrees of leeway, but we can hold that course in a northeast trade." "Ah, good boat," he mumbled, and then repeated 4.5 knots, and started counting on his fingers. Pretty soon he said, "You leave here tonight, 11 o'clock. You go 4.5 knots, not 4 knots, not 5 knots, 4.5 knots. "Very well, Captain, we can do that." "You steer course, careful." "Very well, Captain, we can do that. My boys and my wife, we are all good helmsmen." "Tomorrow morning, daybreak, you look west." Soon you will see breaking reef and one big rock called Cock Rock. He pointed to it on the chart, and sure as heck, there it was. Then you look northwest, see small key, Bobel Key, one palm tree. And there it was on the chart. These were such small places, I had taken them to be all just part of the reef. About 7 o'clock, you turn west, pass between Bobel Key and Cock Rock, head for Cabo Gracias. Before parting, I told him that we had come close to crossing paths before. I had seen his boat in 1956, a 66-foot, very burdensome, well-used trading schooner, island-built. I told him I had seen it at San Andres in 1956, where she had been hauled out for a refurbish, and I watched the whole island, some 700 people, show up to physically pick the ship up and carry it into the water. Everybody taking turns, including me and my companion Wolfie. As she nearly came afloat, Wolfie and I both dived down, stood on the bottom, and held our breath while pushing up on people who were, in turn, pushing up on the ship. He laughed for the first time and said, "Oh, yes, that be the island way. But you see the sea runner there?" For indeed, that was her name. I said, "Yes." He said, "I spend my life in that boat." And motioning toward his instruments, he said, "Since I age 14, I spend my life in that boat. Now she melting in the mud at La Ceiba, being eaten by the worms. Soon I go the same way." But soon he brightened and said, "You go now, young captain, and fair winds to you, fair winds. That's the nicest thing one sailor man can wish for another. Fair winds." Well, that's where I learned to say it.
Hey, Tiger Dude. You've done it again, even with this drawn-out format. Your listeners say that half an hour is okay, but you haven't even started on your navigation story with Joanna. You tell me not to interrupt, but unless you want to lose listeners, you'd better break it up here and get your silly story straight for next time. You hear?
Oh, man. What is it? I just can't help myself. I get hung up in the details. But I don't know. That's what makes all the difference to me. How about you? I appreciate your patience. Hope you'll come back for the rest of the story. Ta-da. Bye-bye. Thank you.